Cinephiles Radio. I'm your host, Steve Pisa. Today we have a wonderful guest on today. It's Tim Russell. Tim Russell is a great actor. The name might not be familiar to you, but Tuvok from Star Trek Voyager might be familiar to you. What's interesting about Tim Russell is that he's been in serial television since 1984. We're going to talk to him about his career, his childhood, his father being in the Air Force and traveling around the world, to serial television, to a lot of the movies that he's been in, to his music. Can't wait to talk to him. Been looking forward to this. Been reaching out for quite a while now. How are you doing during this quarantine time? Staying safe? Staying inside? Give us a call. 515-602-9609. I want to hear from you. What are you watching right now? I'm watching, again, The Mandalorian. I'm watching The Mandalorian all over again. I think this is the sixth time I've been watching it all the way through. Watching a lot of Marvel movies. I love watching the original Ant-Man. What a great movie. I have a television called Tiger King. Now, I'm going to keep on hating on this show because it's kind of like one of the reasons why television isn't in dumpsters these days. Like, the show is so negative. I know people are watching it for junk TV and what have you, but at a time where things are already negative, it just seems like the reason why our society has gone to the dumpsters. So I really don't want to watch that. But Community is now on Netflix. So I've been rewatching Community. What a great show. I don't know if you know this, but the Russo brothers started their career doing a lot of Community shows. They did the episodes of the D&D episodes. Those were fantastic. I've been watching Star Trek Picard. Love that show. Just had a season finale. I didn't notice, but one of my friends played one of the characters on the last episode of that. That must have been a lot of fun. Sir Patrick Stewart must be a lot of fun to be around. I don't know if you're watching his Instagram, but he's reading Shakespeare every night to an audience. That's very sweet of him. Trying to keep people calm in a time of uncalmness. Or is that a word, uncalmness? To put it simple, I don't think people are very calm. People make a lot of jokes about people going to the market to grab toilet paper. What's funny about that is I have not been able to get a decent roll of toilet paper since this whole thing has happened. You gotta make a TV show about that. Or at least a YouTube episode. I've been watching Self-Made with Octavia Spencer. Now, that's a four-part series with Octavia Spencer. It's a great show. Very creative, very colorful, very beautiful. It reminds me a lot of, you know, what if Baz Luhrmann did it? I mean, not a whole deal, but in certain parts it does. A wonderful, wonderful show. Self-Made with Octavia Spencer. Give us a call, 515-602-9609. Let us know what you're watching, what you're binging. I saw a lot of Marvel movies were pushed back recently. Widow pushed back. The Batman has stopped production. Thankfully, Spider-Man is not, because it's going to come out in a couple years. So a couple of these movies are in safe ground. Black Panther 2 is still coming out in 2021 in May. Thank God for that. I'm looking forward to those great movies. Ant-Man 3 is supposed to be coming out very soon, another year. It's funny now that we're saying we can't wait for these movies to come out, but it's like literally a year away. But when you look at the Marvel slate, there's a movie coming out every like 4 months, 3 to 4 months. The only problem now is, you know, since we do have, you know, an issue with the coronavirus, you know, there's not that guarantee. There's not that, like, Venom 2 is already, it's already finished. They're just doing post-production on it. But there's no guarantee that the coronavirus will be done with when you release the film, so you won't have an audience. So you'll have made a film for, like, you know, $110 million, put another $90 million into the budget to advertise the film, and then you don't have an audience to watch it. You know, they were talking about putting Black Widow on Disney Plus, but that movie has the potential to make $1 billion. You put that film on Disney Plus and you don't see it, any of that money. I don't think that's right. I don't think it's right to have the first, you know, we've been waiting for a Black Widow movie for a very long time. Very, very long time. And now that she has her own solo film, it would be hate to see her relegated to being put on Disney Plus instead of having her own venue in a movie. So I'm really hoping they stay away from that. I think New Mutants, Marvel's New Mutants, that was first made by Fox, I think that's going to Disney Plus. Have you ever read the New Mutant comic books? Those were incredible comic books. What was the name of one of the characters? Wolfsbane, and then you had Cannonball. Great character, Sunspot. You had great characters. You had Magic. And great characters on that comic book and in the movie. I'm looking forward to seeing that. Magic's one of my favorite characters. She's the sister of Colossus. When she was a child, she was stolen and taken to hell. And then when he saw her again, which was like a year later, she was already a teenager, because she grew within those years. It was like a time-space kind of thing. That was freaky. But a great, great comic book. And hopefully it'll be a great movie. They wanted to tout it as being the first ever Marvel horror film, which of course now they're calling Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. I'm looking forward to seeing Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. That's going to come after WandaVision, and they're going to tie in together. A lot of people are believing that Wanda will be the bad guy in Doctor Strange, but I doubt that very highly. I think if anything, they'll find a way to bring Vision back. But there is a lot of comic books that show how powerful she is and how she can create her own reality. That might be something that gets changed and switched around. So so many things to look forward to out there. You know, I don't know about you, but I've always counted on movies and media to be the thing that pushes me through a lot of depression. I know it sounds silly, but, you know, I've used a lot of these films to make me feel better about, you know, the future and what I'm looking forward to. You know, when I think about, Tim Russ and the generation he grew up in and the movies that he was involved in, he started off his career in 1985. That was the golden age of movies. What is your golden age favorite movie? Is it Ghostbusters? Was it Pee-wee's Herman's Greatest Adventures? Was it Aliens? Did I mention Ghostbusters? I love that movie. Of course, there was Godzilla in 1985. That was a great movie. There was 2010, A Space Odyssey. Oh, 1985 was a great year. Great year for movies. Great year for television. Looking forward to talking to Tim Russ about that. Have you been watching any nighttime television? Jimmy Kimmel and The Tonight Show and The Late Late Show. Stephen Colbert is fantastic. They give you a sense of calm in a non-so-calm time. Myself, I'm looking forward to things going back to the way they were before. But I wonder if they're going to go back to the way they were before. You know, people will shake hands and hug. I think it'll be like a year of adjustment before they do that. I think people will give like the Hollywood hug, you know, where people barely touch each other. You know, that's where the phrase howly comes from. Hawaii, because when the foreigners came over, they wanted to shake hands. But in Hawaii, when you meet someone, you touch heads and breathe towards each other. So you're sharing breath, you're sharing the soul. So shaking hands was so impersonal, was so departed. So I wonder if shaking hands will be a time of the past. I don't know. I like bowing to people. I'm a big fan of that. I see we have a nice audience. Still waiting for Tim Russ to call in. In the meantime, you're stuck with me. Have you been enjoying our episodes? We've had a litany of people coming on. Give me a call. Let me know what you think. 515-602-9609. 515-602-9609. Let me know what you think. You don't have to be so nice. You can be a little harsh. but I am doing the best I can. You know, let's put on a song by Sage. You know, I love Sage. I had her on recently. You know, commonly known as Sage Boatwright. She's an excellent artist. She sings a song called June. Let's hear that song.
Didn't wanna write a love song. Usually these things come out wrong. But you've been up in my head all day long, and now I'm all gone, yeah. Didn't know we'd end up this way. Keeping memories on replay. Yeah, you make me wanna catch the bouquet. I just wanna stay.
Sage Boatwright. What a great song. She's got a wonderful voice. Let's listen to another song. You know, one video game that I really love is called Child of Light. Now, for a long time, it was free on Xbox and PS4. The one great thing they had on there was the soundtrack. It was amazing. I want to play you a little snippet of a song. It's one of my favorites.
Thank you.
Child of Light. I love that. I love that game a great deal. I see that we have Tim Russin. Let's bring him in. Hello, Tim. How are you doing, sir?
Doing all right. Doing all right under the circumstances.
Well, we got you in here.
Good. Good.
Now, before we get started, how are you and your family doing right now in the quarantine times?
We're doing okay. We're going through the paces and staying sequestered, staying the extra things that need to be done. So far so good. No, it's
good. Are you here in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I'm here in Los Angeles for sure.
Okay.
West Hollywood, to be exact. And then I've got my mother in Sacramento. She's doing well.
Good.
Yeah, my brother's in Florida.
Wow.
He's doing okay. And my sister's in Long Beach. And
oh,
she is
good.
Doing okay. Yeah,
that's
everybody's
good.
So far.
Yeah. Well, Florida was a hot spot for a little while there. So I'm glad he's doing well.
Yeah, right.
I know. I mean, the fact those kids going out there to the ocean and just playing along was insane to me.
Yeah, that was a little. Yeah, that was ridiculous, actually, for them to, to take off and expose themselves and everybody else to, potentially catching a virus, when there was no need to do that. I mean, that was
right.
That was crazy. I don't know what anybody was thinking or.
No,
some
of the kids were.
If anybody was thinking,
No, I don't think they were thinking at all. Some of the kids were saying, if I catch it, I catch it. Yeah, but you can spread it to people who don't want to get a cat.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. If they could become carriers and they could become asymptomatic characters, so they don't carriers, so they don't get the symptoms, and so they don't know they have anything.
Right.
So yeah, that's not happening at all, really.
Yeah.
It's just not. It's not smart. It's not practical. Doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Right. So there you go.
Well, I'm glad your family is doing well. Speaking of your family, you grew up with in an Air Force family.
Yes, I did. I grew up in the Air Force family. Yep. Yeah.
Wow.
My father was
in
Air Force. Yeah.
And by the time you were a teenager, you traveled the world already.
Yeah, we lived in the Middle East and we lived in Asia as well, for a number of years.
So, you went to school in Rome,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we did. I went to school in upstate New York. I went to school in Turkey. I went to school in Taiwan and the Philippines. The school I went to, high school I went to was in Rome, New York, so
right.
It wasn't.
Oh, Rome, New York.
It was Rome. It was Rome, New York.
Right.
Yeah, the city of
right.
Rome, New York. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. One of your resume is one of those resumes that it's impossible to do like a 2-hour show on because you were literally growing up in Hollywood in a time where it was the golden age of television and the golden age of movies. It's incredible. I mean, how was it like growing up we're not in any different age, you and I, we're almost the same age, but watching how I've seen, some people I have to fake watching their shows or maybe I didn't see their shows, but I've seen literally almost every single show you've been on because the shows that you were on, there was only 6 channels in the world.
That is correct. I started working on camera in the business full-time around 1985.
Right.
I didn't move here till 81 to L.A., so I started working 85 to now. So, during those early years of the series that we're on, at that time, I think we were just starting to expand into cable into Showtime and HBO was just on the horizon, but they were starting
HBO
to get into
and ZTV as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And so they were starting at that time to get into extra cable channels were starting to come in and syndicated channels are coming in. And, without cable, you're still stuck with 3, the networks and stuff. So you had to get cable. You had to pay per month for the cable. And along with that came, the extra cable channels, and eventually Showtime and HBO. And those.
Well, they didn't have any serial television on there. I mean, the first show really that's kind of a big hit that I see that you're on was Hill Street Blues, which I watched like religiously. Hill Street Blues is an amazing show. You know, I've done casting for quite a lot of years. What was it like being casted for Hill Street Blues when it was really at the height of its monolithic career?
Well, you know, it was for me, it would have been like any other show. And quite frankly, any of the gigs that you see on the, you know, on IMDb, the quite frankly, the television episodic stuff has all been, for the most part, kind of routine and typical and not that unusual for the roles I played. All of that stuff was just cookie cutter type of roles. Some better than others, whatever. But, you know, at the time, all I thought was, you know, yeah, Hill Street Blues is well known. It is a popular show.
Right.
It's cool to have a shot at it. But at the end of the day, it's a gig that I needed to have, period. You know, that's the main thing is it's work.
Right.
So
in order for you to further your career. Yeah.
Yeah. In order to keep going. Sure. And it's a good thing that it was a network show. It's a good thing that it was a popular show. But quite frankly, any network show that I could have gotten on was just, you know, that was all happening. It was all good stuff. And then if there were some movies or features that came in, that's, you know, even better, actually.
Like Spaceballs.
But, yeah, like Spaceball, something. So those typically, the feature films, whether they were independent or even sometimes large, big budget movies, but mostly independent films, were the ones that were the most interesting to work on because they, you know, the roles almost always are unusual or different and more of a creative challenge. Whereas the television stuff, man, those are, you know, interchangeable almost, because I'm usually end up playing the same types of roles all the time.
Right,
you know, and
right.
It's just the way things are, you know.
Well, you were in Starman and all, like I was saying, you're going on a lot of these serial television shows. I can see how you can say they're cookie cutter and what have you, because it does seem like the career path will take you down that road and you will be casted for these shows because they are the regulated shows that are on all these channels.
Yeah, they are. It's the same genre. I mean, they're still doing them now, and I'm still playing in them now. They're still, you know, the shows are doctor, lawyer, police dramas, soap operas, you know, those are the three main sort of projects that are doing, and emergency shows now, really big, you know, fire department, EMT shows, things like that. Those are just unbelievably popular. They just keep doing the same things over and over. There's at least six doctor shows, seven doctor shows, whatever. I've been on two of them, playing the same type of role. So, you know, literally the same type role in both places.
Right.
So, you know, because the storylines are going to be it's the same thing over and over and over again. And, you know, whether it's an older audience watching it, generally it is, or whether it's some people who are younger who've never seen those types of shows and get hooked into them, maybe. But most of the young people aren't even watching, you know, regular series television anymore. You know, because they're just looking at Netflix and Hulu and the streaming stuff. They just watch all the episodes at once.
Right.
And those streaming shows can be, you know, fairly different. I mean, that's one thing about the difference between network television and what you see now on streaming networks aren't doing a lot of the stock stuff. And if they are, they're doing it it's off the nose. It's like, it's eccentric or it's, you know, unusual or it's edgy or it's something else. They aren't really doing that much of that kind of stuff. They're doing mostly, you know, a lot of supernatural stuff, a lot of fantasy, some horror, some action, some this, that, and the other things. So they can go anywhere they want, do anything they want. They can be as crude or as edgy, as blue, or as, you know, whatever, a rough and tumble, because they have the option to do that because it's a streaming thing that you pay for, unlike HBO. Not unlike HBO, who had challenging series, you know.
Well, coming from serial television, at what point did you feel like things have been changing? Because, you know, everything changed maybe about 10, 12 years ago when Netflix came into play, and then Amazon Prime, and then now we have Apple Plus and Disney Plus and what have you. How does it feel to live in this kind of world now compared to like 1984, 1985 for the Hill Street Blues days, where now you have more of an option to play so many, like a litany of characters compared to being tied into like the same old, like we said, cookie cutter characters?
Yeah, well, the whole thing about the streaming services, not only for myself as an actor, but for viewers as well, you have the buffet table just got about 30 feet longer.
Right.
You know, with a lot more variety on the table. So, you know, when it comes to potential roles and the types of roles I might end up doing, you know, yeah, the opportunities are far more vast now than they were before. Just
absolutely.
not even just in terms of volume, and in terms of the possibilities of outlets and opportunities for work. The only thing about some of them is that, you know, your pay scale is different for cable and stream as opposed to network. Network is the best place to work for as far as compensation goes and residuals and things. But from a business standpoint, but from, you know, creatively, you're going to have more of a variety of types of shows in cable, and also a variety in and also a little bit more of a volume. Now, that being said, a lot of the cable stuff, a lot of the streaming stuff isn't shot here. A lot of it's shot in, you know, Canada or New York or Atlanta or someplace else. So those jobs that I would normally have in potentially playing supporting roles, those supporting roles are not here anymore. They're gone.
No,
so
they're in Canada now, Vancouver.
Yeah, or New York or Atlanta. Toronto or Vancouver. So I'm not getting a chance to read for a lot of those supporting roles because they're going to hire somebody local, you know, potentially. They'll read some of the series. Regular roles will be read, you know, out of L.A. and maybe chosen here, but most of them are going to be from somewhere else. Like, they might get them from New York. They might get them from Atlanta. Wherever it is, there's a lot of parts and roles that are not available on the streaming services because they don't shoot here.
Right.
When I was in the 1980s, everything shot in L.A.
Right.
Everything was shooting here. There was
we had chips out here. We had everything was out here.
You had everything out here. I think the only thing that the Stephen J. Cannell started shooting out of town. He started shooting Hunter up in Vancouver. They just had started shooting in Vancouver. He had opened up a production company in Vancouver. So his shows shot up in Canada. And had just started doing that in the 1980s. I want to say the late 80s, early 90s.
Right.
They were starting to shoot up there in Canada. And so he opened the door to all of that. And then later on, the country itself, the government got on board with incentive programs that were heavy. So
There was a lot of tax incentives out there.
Yeah, so everybody else came running. But, you know, back then the studios were all independently owned. They're not, you know, and then, you know, now they're all major corporations that own them. And so major corporations only care about the bottom line. They don't care about anything else. So they're looking at quarterly profits. And if the show is going to shoot somewhere where they can save that X amount of dollars, you know, regardless of whether or not you keep seeing the same actors, you know, three times in a series because, you know, they don't have that much of an actor pool up there. They don't care. They're just going to do it.
Well,
so,
that's funny because a lot of their actors came out to L.A. thinking that all the jobs were out here.
Yeah, some of them were moved up. Some of them did move to another city. Some of them did go, you know, out of town to go work in other places and, you know, over time. But at the end of the day, the difference is that, you know, in terms of, like I said, in terms of business and stuff, that the opportunities for supporting roles, supporting leads, the guest star roles, will diminish over time.
Right.
I read very rarely for, you know, guest star roles that shoot out of town. And most of the time, you know, so the amount of work could in fact be less because of the runaway production rather than beneficial to me in terms of the opportunities for different types of roles. Right. That includes low budget or independent medium budget films. They don't shoot here either. They shoot somewhere else.
Right. Right.
So, you know, there's all those parts are gone. So it's very thin when it comes to this.
Let's roll back a little bit. You know, you went to college, you went to university for theater. How was that like, and did your family support you at that time when you were, because it's not a popular time for people to go to theater. A lot of people would say, you know, you better get a major. How was it like at that time majoring in theater?
Well, you know, ultimately, I got a Bachelor of Science as a college degree. A college degree is a college degree. 4 years
right.
undergraduate degree, all it means is you went to school and completed a college degree.
Right.
You know, you could study that, or you could study horticulture, you could study, basket weaving and get a degree if they offered it. It wouldn't matter. As long as all they care about is that you got a degree. That's all it.
Right.
That's all that matters. That's just the nuts
right.
and bolts and mechanics of it, right?
Right.
Your degree's not going to matter unless you're going to get a master's or a PhD. And then
right.
you're topical and you can go work in those areas and they're going to look for those degrees. But,
right.
you know, I went to school to get the 4-year degree, but I went to a particular university that had a really serious theater program. And as a matter
right.
of fact, that program is not the same anymore. They've changed it. Now it's more in line with a regular 4-year college university where they have 2 first years very heavy in general ed, and then you finally get to step up and do some serious stuff in the last 2 years.
Oh, that's
when
nice.
When I went, you started. It was like a trade school in theater. That's what it was structured like. And when I went, I took maybe anywhere between 8 to 10 hours of theater, and only 1 or 3 or 4 hours of general ed per semester. The rest of it was all theater. So you were immersed in the theater program in
right.
all these different areas of theater, not just
was
acting,
it was it
directing.
Focusing on like Meisner and what have you?
There were a couple of different acting teachers, and they all had their own methods that they used. We had somebody that was method. We had somebody that was more technique.
Right.
We had somebody that focused on dialect. We had somebody that focused on, you know, these different areas. So we took different classes with each instructor to get, you know, a sort of a rounded approach. Plus you had directing, playwriting, you had box office, costume and wardrobe, construction, lighting, sound,
right.
all that stuff you could do. You could actually have hands-on working from the time you got there as an undergraduate and as a freshman in the shows. You were working on main stage plays and you were working on student plays.
Right.
And they brought out celebrity actors from Hollywood to be in the plays.
Wow.
So now you had 4 shows during the year, school year, and 3 shows during the summer, all with name actors
from LA
or from New York.
Hello?
Yep, I'm here. You there?
Yep, I'm here.
Yeah. So you had name actors in those shows during the school year and during the summer, who the director, the artistic director brought out from LA. So some of them are very well known. Some of them maybe, you know, more character actors from years back, but they came out and did the shows. You know, I worked
wow.
with Leonard Nimoy, ironically enough. I worked with Mercedes from Cambridge, Jackie Coogan. I worked with Greg Morris, the late Greg Morris, Donnie Most. I mean, we worked with a lot of people over the time I was there, and they were in the main stage shows with us, the students, in those plays. And that's
wow.
what drew the public, the city, you know, the people from the city to come, patrons to come watch the plays, because we had, you know, celebrity name actors in the shows. So it was run like a regular professional, either regional theater or touring theater, with a lead actor in it, star lead actor in it. And then we had the directing, the shows that were run by the students
right.
in their second or third year got to direct their shows as well. They would do short 1-act plays and they got to direct those plays. So, you know, it was, It was quite the lesson. I got so much. I learned so much in a relatively short period of time. And I even graduated a semester ahead of what I was supposed to graduate. So I got out a whole semester early, because I stayed there and did summer school twice. So at the end of the day, that was the way to go. It was theater 24/7. It was around the clock. Working in some capacity on the shows. It was great. It was really great. It was a great opportunity to have. To be able to participate in that program when I did. Nothing but timing on that, because if I went there now, it would be very different than it was. So, and a chance to get on stage, a chance to actually perform, a chance to direct a play, a chance to learn, the craft in different areas, before you left out. Before I left college, I was working professionally. I got two jobs that I got booked while I was there. I worked on a Masterpiece Theater for PBS with Glenn Turman was the lead actor in it. And then I got my SAG card. And then I worked on another local TV show that was like a sitcom or a family sort of sitcom. I worked on that. It was a regional show. And I got a chance to do that before I even left college. So by the time I came to LA, I already had a head start, and a lot of people who just arrived. So,
right
there it is. That's
when did the music start for you? Because I know you're a musician. When did the music start for you?
Started for me when I was 16. I started playing guitar when I was 16. So that's 45 years ago, roughly.
Wow.
And I started playing, in bands and things at the time, and did a few gigs, I did gigs for different things, and I worked, I kept playing throughout the years in different variations of bands, rock band, a big 7-piece R&B bands, folk, guitar, acoustic guitar in a coffee shop with a microphone kind of thing. Did that for years. Then I came back, did top 40 in a club for 2 years and whatever, when I moved to LA, with another band, and then took a break for a while, came back and started working with a record producer, a record company called Crescendo Records, produced a CD with them, and then went on to do my own with my own band and my own CD. So that's where we are today. So it's a long, winding road, as it were.
You've spent a long time with music. Is that your Would you say that's your second passion?
Depending upon the circumstance, it could be my first passion. I enjoy playing. I enjoy performing live.
Right.
Quite a bit because it's live.
Right.
Television and film that pays the bills. Television and film pays the bills.
Right.
I enjoy performing live because you have a live audience, and
sure.
And it's much more exciting and much more exhilarating than working in single camera or whatever it comes out to. It's usually single camera.
Sure.
If it's a live comedy with a live 4-camera comedy with a live audience, now that's fun. That's
right.
A challenge, and that's a kick. So those kinds of gigs are great as far as working in front of camera, but overall, if you have a live audience, man, that's what the show is, man. It's live theater, live music, live taping, or
Absolutely.
Whatever it is. Yeah.
Now you worked with Leonard Nimoy when you were young. Did you ever watch the original Star Trek show yourself? I mean, I'm pretty sure the answer is yes, but did you watch the original Star Trek show?
Well, yeah, because. I watched that as much as I watched I Love Lucy and Gilligan's Island. I mean, they played those series pretty much endlessly on syndicated television. I mean, if you turn the channel past, the major networks there, that's what you're going to see. Andy at Mayberry. I know all those. I know all the shows and all the episodes and all the storylines and everything else. And Star Trek is thrown right in there with it. They were all running them in syndication at that time. On maybe one channel, that you might have had, because we had antennas back in those days. So,
I remember when Star Trek Generations came out. I mean, I literally ran to go see those episodes. It was the first time I believe that Paramount had their own TV station here in LA on Channel 13.
Sure,
that was incredible.
Yeah, that was they eventually got the UPN network going, but they were ultimately, you know, when they resurrected the show, and that's because the show had been in syndication for years, you know, a couple of decades,
right,
or more, of showing that thing over and over, and they didn't realize, you know, they eventually realized, oh, there's a big audience for this thing. We need to,
right,
you know, maybe reboot it since we own it, you know, just reboot
right
it and put it back on again. And
right,
and thus they did. So
it was incredible. With Sir Patrick Stewart, it was amazing. And now, you were in Star Trek Generations, and it was way after this show was off syndication, what have you.
Yeah.
How was that experience for you? It must have been amazing.
How was what? What's that?
How was it like being in Star Trek Generations, the movie?
It was cool. I got a chance to work with, you know, those actors from the original series, all pretty
right
much in one day, just about. And that was pretty much a kick to be able to do that, I guess, because they are iconic. And
right,
and it was a feature film project. So we know it's going to be, you know, in the movie theaters.
Right.
And so that's it's a big positive on all of those things,
right,
as far as that goes. And a chance to, like I said, work with some of the actors from the original series.
Sure.
I ended up working with quite a few of them over the years, but, you know, but yeah, that was kind of
yeah
cool. Yeah.
I love Jonathan Frakes himself. It's very interesting. When Star Trek Voyager, which I'll jump to right now, when Star Trek Voyager was first going to come out, I remember the press releases about the show before it came out, watching the blueprints of the
yeah
ship before they even showed it to anybody. You know, and it was the slow release. There was no Instagram. There was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. You had to pick up magazines back in those days and see
yeah
what people are doing with these TV shows. I would like to know how amazing it was for you to have gone from all these experiences, you know, being with Leonard Nimoy when you were young, going through all these experiences of watching syndicated television, and then you yourself being such a pop culture TV, because there's two things. There's Star Wars and there's Star Trek. Star Wars is art and Star Trek is science. And it's such a brain tease for a lot of people. People just love it so much. And you were in, to me, the second best show that was released. I did like Deep Space Nine. I mean, I did enjoy it, but Voyager was a show that I was addicted to, like the character Paris and what have you. I mean, I love that show. Seven of Nine. I love that show.
Yeah. You know, the reason that Voyager became so popular is because it was a throwback to the original series.
Yeah.
It was uncharted, unexplored space. So your storylines
right
are completely wide open. You can do whatever you want. You're not
right
tied to any folklore or any characters or any circumstances, situations that are already established,
right,
you know, in their home base. So, you know, I think one of the reasons that show did as well as it did was because of the concept and where they placed the ship, you know,
right,
so that they could get away with exploring, you know, uncharted space. That's the way the original series began.
Yeah, they were smart to go to the Delta Quadrant where nobody knew what anything was, and you can just recreate, you know, any kind of monster or
anything you
alien
want
that you want.
Anything
you
want.
Yeah.
Anything you want. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Literally anything you want. And
yeah
get away with it because nobody's
right
seen it before. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
One series is based a little bit more on pseudoscience. The other one is based on, you know, action and getting along with it. I don't necessarily, for myself, I don't find, you know, tech talk that appealing. You know, I think it's more interesting in terms of the characters and the emotional interactions between them and what they have to do. Because if you look at the original series, the dialogue in there does not heavy with tech talk.
Right.
It's not heavy at all. It hardly has any. And it actually ran longer. It ran 10 minutes longer than the shows run now.
Right.
So You know, so you don't necessarily need all of that to tell a story. It's all about, you know, what the circumstance is and then how you're going to get yourself out of it, or what somebody is doing or saying or whatever, you know, and then how do we deal with this problem?
Right.
And we had a few episodes, you know, quite a number of episodes where there wasn't so much of that going on. I think when you get into that stuff, it just isn't, these days I'm particularly not interested in playing in any role that has a lot of jargon, you know, and it doesn't matter whether it's sci-fi or whether it's lawyer speak or doctor speak, because all three of those are the same. It's
right.
Jargon, you know, like who cares, you know, why the doctor has to explain the operation. We don't give a rat's ass about the rod, what the hell, the, you know, what drug and what this and what procedure and what blah, blah, blah. Just show it to us, you know.
Right.
You know,
right.
And or let's you know, you go into the operating room and then we come out. And what's happening after they come out of the operating room? How is the patient feeling? What's
right.
the relationship between the patient and their family? What's the relationship between the patient and the doctor? Whatever. You know, rather than, you know, explaining to someone a bunch of medical jargon. And the same with the lawyers speak. I mean, I don't want to hear a bunch of, you know, legalese rather than,
right.
you know, what the case is about, you know, who did what and why and where and how. That's more interesting
right.
than
more character study.
It's yeah. The more minutia of how we're going to, what the procedure is, or minutia about the technical aspects of it. That's boring to me. I could yawn all day long listening to that.
Right.
Not interested.
Right.
Not interested at all. You know,
right.
and it's not, you know, I understand everybody's more, a little more tech savvy, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day,
right.
if you come across an unusual phenomenon, you know, I think just the minimum of the tech talk to try to deal with the phenomenon. You know,
right.
if you're going to scan it, don't have to explain how or why, you know, what the particulars are of scanning it, just scan it, you know,
right.
or, you know, analyze it, or, you know, what's it made of or whatever. And, you know, what kind of harm could it have or do to us? What
you
should we do about it, you know?
You're reminding me a lot of Paul Rudd in Ant-Man, where he's like clueless of the science, and he goes, "Do you guys just put quantum in the front of everything that you say?"
Yeah, yeah,
because it's just jargon.
I mean, that's where I am now with all that stuff. I don't like to play it, and I don't like to watch it, to be honest with
yeah.
you. I mean, I don't watch that stuff, and I prefer not to have to play it. If I'm looking at if I'm reading for a part and I see all that nonsense in it, I'm pretty much going to pass on it.
Well, I've seen you played a lot of that in your past. I mean, you've been in a, you know, like ER. You've been in a lot of shows that have had jargon, so I can see why you've taken on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I haven't had anything super super heavy. I mean, I played a couple. I read for something that was super heavy, and it was just obnoxious. It was so bad. I didn't get the role. I didn't care about the role because it was ridiculous, you know. If I have to look at that stuff now, I'm more than likely going to pass on it. You know, I want to see some kind of character reaction, character motivation, character interaction. Some kind of emotional arc, some kind of decision that has to be made. You know,
right.
if it's a comedy, you really don't have to do that much stuff in a comedy. But the dramas, I'd like to do something. It's just, you know, who cares, you know, whether or not it's a gobbledygook or giggity gig or whatever it might be. I don't care about any of that. what has that got to do with anything? So
right. Well, I see you're an iCarly. I mean, that must have been the farthest removed from gobbledygook.
Oh yeah, yeah. Comedy, man, is always fun. I wish we would have had a live audience. Unfortunately, we didn't. But because the show is very difficult to do. So
right.
There's a lot of gags and things like that, and physical
right.
stuff and whatever. So even if you shot it just as is, and you know, but even then, you know, the finished product was very, very funny the way it was put together, and the dialogue was always really good, and the exec producer Dan Schneider used to do a really good job at writing and working it and changing it and, you know, trying this and trying that to see which might be the funniest, and then they put it together in post. So it was a very, very fun show to work on. It was a lot of work. I mean, Dan Schneider worked you. He worked you that day. That was a long day.
Yeah.
When you got in front of the camera to work. That you were working. And the kids on there were great to work with. Everybody on there was great to work with.
All professionals.
Yeah, 110%, man. And not just what you see on the camera. I'm talking about just on the set and going through the process. They were bringing it. And there was no cutting up. There was no acting out. There was no attitude. There was no unprofessionalism. They were serious, and their personality was always the same. They would smile and you know, have a laugh or whatever joke, but they would never the production to lose money or time in the days that I worked on it. I never saw it.
I can see there's such a huge difference between the old generation of maybe the 90s kids who had, you know, TV shows and what have you to the kids today that have a TV show, who would take it very, very seriously because they've seen the kids of the past ruin their careers based upon just their simple attitude of being wrong.
100%. Yeah. I haven't worked on any shows currently. I did work on one show recently. It only did a couple of seasons, I think. That was pretty, it's a couple of young people on it, and they were very, very good. They worked very hard. They were disciplined. They were professional. And they were more millennial. I want to say, you know, maybe they were high school. They were playing high school or college. I think it was either high school or just early college. I can't remember which one. I think it might have been college. But they were very good.
Nice.
They came, they delivered, they did the job, and everything was cool in that. So I haven't worked on any other, what was it, family? Not the hell, what was that one? There was one I did with a young family and worked with a couple of kids in there, but I didn't actually have any scenes with the kids. So the last one that would have been the heaviest would have been iCarly, and that was a number of years ago. So.
Sure. You also did Arrested Development, which is a fantastic show.
Yes, Arrested Development, yep.
Yeah, that must have been the farthest from a lot of, you know, TikTok, you know, kind of shows you got, because that's pretty much just a lot of straight-off riffing,
Yeah, right, exactly. It's also worked on Hulu's show Pen 15, which is all kids.
Actually, I did that.
Not all kids, because producers are lead actresses are in 30 something, so they're not kids. The other actors on there that were children, or young people, or younger, they delivered because it takes place in a high school. So
I see. You worked on Supergirl as well, and those are to me millennials as well. I mean, that's hit a brand new audience right there. And now that show is, I believe, was filmed in Canada. I mean, am I wrong on that one?
That is correct. That is correct. And it's filmed up in Vancouver. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a fantastic show. And I did see you in that episode. It's a fantastic show.
Yeah, that seemed to have been done very well. It was done was directed professionally, done very well. And acted very well. The lead character that plays Supergirl was just wonderful, beautiful personality.
She's wonderful.
Time to talk to her off set, and she had a hell of a hard day that day. I mean, dialogue up the wazoo. So she came out with all that stuff, got it dead on, got it right, multiple takes and coverage, and she. You know, when she came off, it was like, you know, and she sat down, we would talk, and then, but, you know, just very personable, very sweet, enjoyed.
What I like, you know, what I like about her is that she knew the break that she got when she got that show, because she got it before Superman got it. Now, Superman is going to have a show, I think, next season, but Supergirl started first, and I think she knew really the break that she got when that show came out, and it hit hard.
Well, I should hope it does well. We're in the Marvel years for now, or the DC years.
Yep.
You know, it's about comic books coming to life. That's what they're doing, you know, because
yep.
we have CG and we're able to make it look very realistic. So
right.
that's the theme for the day, and it's going to be there as long as the corpse can milk it and make as much money as they can.
You know, yeah. I grew up with a minor learning disability, and I collected comic books as a kid, and you know, people like Stan Lee really taught me how to write novels. And I'm always going to give him credit
yeah.
for that, because he taught me quantum mechanics. He taught me about how to differentiate between characters, how to change things up in a millisecond. So I really do give him a gigantic amount of credit. I'm not a big fan of overdoing it the way people are overdoing it right now, but I have enjoyed watching the people that I've loved for all these years coming to the big screen.
Yeah. I grew up with many of these characters that they put on the screen now, which is, you know, and it is interesting to see, because they can make it look so realistic.
Right.
That these characters come to life. It is kind of cool. You know, I do have my, you know, for preferences and criticisms here and there about all this.
Sure.
But ultimately, yeah, it's interesting to see it. I read the comics growing up as well, because we had, you know, that's what we did back then. You know,
right.
We didn't have iPhones and
nope.
YouTube and Instagram. We had, you know, you had to go get a comic book, you know, and
that's
and
right. 10
and,
cents.
Yeah. And so, and go play in the yard and pretend and make believe. So,
know.
You know, now it's, you know, to see the stuff come to life on the screen, in the just these giant, features that they're making. Yeah. Some of it is pretty interesting. Some of it is pretty cool, to go along with that. You know, but like I said, you know, how long are they going to play that note? How long are they going to do
right.
it? You know, when is it going to become? Is it maybe 20 minutes after people don't go see it? They're gonna, you know,
right.
it's going to be the end of that. And be off,
I think eventually, there'll be fatigue, and it'll go back to the independent
yeah.
films and what have you.
Now,
yeah,
there's something about
Star Trek for you that you just continued on doing other Star Trek properties after Voyager. What is it about the Star Trek property that kind of motivates you to do all these other projects afterwards?
It's not the Star Trek property so much as it is, you know, I got a call from
involved.
A producer about doing a project. You know, I just got a call
yeah.
and I said that he wanted, you want to direct this pilot presentation. That's what it was. Those are pilot presentations.
Oh.
They were doing them as samples. They were doing them as demos.
Right.
So hopefully to try to sell them. And, you know, it's fine. It's great.
Sure.
I said, yeah, sure, I'll shoot it. Because at the time I was have been directing projects as well.
Right.
So it was an opportunity to do that and get some science fiction stuff under my belt. And that's what I wanted to do. So
sure.
now, you know, I have that genre that I've shot, and I can use that as an example if somebody else comes along with something else.
Right.
So, and consequently, one of the people that worked on it in post is now working on something else from scratch from the beginning, which I'm developing with him, and we're hoping to shoot that as a feature down the line. And that's what I'm saying. I mean,
well, that's incredible.
You know, as a director and also, you know, doing post-production, I worked with him. So he knows my work. He likes the way I work. He likes what I've shot and how I've done it. And you know, wants to work with me. So that one led to the other. So you don't, these opportunities when they come up, you know,
right.
Typically the door is open for this job that you do to lead to another job.
Right.
Or the job after that, because
right.
it may be the director, maybe the producer,
you've done cinematography, you've directed, I mean, you've done everything. So I can
yeah,
see how
mostly.
you're just building up your resume there.
Yeah, well, mostly the majority of stuff I've done some co-writing, and I've done some rewriting, and I don't, you know, I don't consider myself a writer per se, because I don't make a living as a writer. I have
right.
written and revised feature film scripts here and there because they desperately needed it. And I've directed, you know, and also developed story on several projects. So if the producer is going to, if somebody calls me out of the blue and says, hey, you know, would you like to, you know, work with me directing this feature? And I said, yeah, sure, man. What do you have? And in those two instances, initially, as far back as Gods and Men, they didn't have a script. We didn't have a script, you know, nothing. They had nothing. They just had, they were going to do this thing. And they had a couple of writers, and I said, well, we'll sit down and we'll hash out a story. Why don't we do a story with this basic concept? And then we started banging everything, putting everything together, and then we got the money to go ahead and make it. So those jobs came to me. And the only other way you're going to get those gigs is if you have a relationship with somebody who's got the potential to make a project and you can sign on as a director. Or it's your own project, which you have brought to fruition, and you've got somebody interested to buy it or back it, and then you can shoot it then. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to happen. In some cases, I directed a feature. It was a co-directed feature with four different directors, recently called Life on the Rocks. And the reason was because the film is a compilation of stories. Individual stories that are sort of overlapped or linked in the same location. Right. So each story is almost a standalone. And so they had a different director for each story. That's the way he wanted to do it. So I said, okay, well, you know, come on board, I'll shoot this. And that was a referral. That was just a referral. I'd worked with one of the co-producers on it, and he remembered me, and they were looking for somebody to shoot. He gave me a call. He says, how would you like to direct, you know, one of these episodes? I said, hell yeah, that would be fabulous. Let's do it. So we ended up doing just that. And, and it came out, it turned out pretty well, and that's it. And I even had a chance on that one to work, you know, going over the dialogue and trying to get and doing some of the dialogue changes and editing and things like that. So the opportunities to get behind camera on a project are usually random and or a referral, a reference, and or something that you've done yourself. It's just that they do list and advertise. Sometimes they will list on online agencies here and there that we're looking for a director for blah, blah, blah. I did pick up one job like that where there was an ad for a director for a short film. I sent in my material. They got back to me. And they ended up hiring me to shoot their short film. And it was a short film that was more like an in-house promotional narrative story. So it's not something that, you know, not something they're going to put in festivals or, you know, that's designed for commercial work. It was designed to promote their company. But it was a story. They shot it here in L.A. We scouted. We laid out the production. We shot the thing. And they did all the post work on it. They did a great job on post, and you know, the whole thing came together very nicely. And I have the whole, you know, I got the film on my computer and the demo, the trailer for it. So, you know, so if I had to show somebody, here's a sample of blah blah blah, you know, this style of short, here it is, this style of film, here it is, this style of blah, whatever, here's the genre. I've got this genre. I've done a period piece. I've done a medieval period piece. I've done science fiction, space, future. I've done a straight drama. I've done romantic comedy. I've done, you know, all of those styles. The only one that I'm missing a solid physical action piece, and I've just finished shooting something that had some of that up in Sacramento. It's a supernatural thriller, whatever they want to call it. So it had some physical fighting and action in it, which is cool. So I haven't done that much of that kind of stuff just yet. So
What got you into video game work? You know, you did a lot of voiceover work for video games like Castle Wolfenstein. I mean, one of my favorite games. What got you into that realm?
That was after working on Voyager. I did, I don't know, four. I think I was still on Voyager. I did four or five audiobooks.
Really?
That I read for. Yeah, I read for at least four or five audiobooks. One of them was a series of two or three stories. Another one was something else. And then I did at least four or five audiobooks. And then after the audiobooks, I went to I tried to secure a voiceover agent, and I did. And then from there, they went to a bigger agency and ended up doing it with them. And then they sent me out for stuff like video games and things like that. I did one or two commercials, but I did a video. Nice. I've done at least a dozen video games. So,
yeah.
So they started sending me. So I've done. It was just sort of a progressive thing because I did the audio books, and then I started doing this stuff.
Right.
And it just turns out that if my voice works for some roles and parts, then that's great. So I still read for them. I still submit for them. And if they book me, that's great. And if not, well, that's the way it goes. So, now voiceover came as a result of having worked on the show.
Right. Well, yeah. we have similar friends that worked on Fifth Passenger. I want to know how was it like working with like Scotty Baker and Manu and a lot of it, the other characters that they were in so many different series in one movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I know Scott. I've known Scott for a while. I knew him long before he shot Fifth Passenger. So
nice.
He worked with me on Renegades to work in camera.
That's right.
On both of those. So he's. You know, always a pleasure to work with Scott. It's always a pleasure to hang out with him. He's a very cool guy, and
he's
very talented. And when he approached me about working on Fifth, I said, "Yeah, sure, man. What's the role?" And I really liked the part. I liked the storyline, and it was a really, really low budget project, but they managed to pull that thing out of the hat and really make a good film. A good looking film when it was all done.
Right.
So, you know, and he went from working camera operator, steady cam camera to actually directing. And he did a really good job, turning that thing out. And it was a pleasure to work with him,
yeah.
You know, on it. And it's a good piece of footage, to have. It's a good project to be associated with. They'd made some money on that. Somebody made some money on it because I've got at least a residual check or two here and there. And so it's done well. I can't say that it isn't done well.
It has. You know. It's on Amazon Prime right now.
Yeah, Amazon Prime. There you go.
Yeah.
It's a good film. It's a really good film. I was very proud to have been a part of it. You know,
people were very kind to them, you know, I know somebody let them borrow one of the sets for the spaceship and what have you. So a lot of people were very kind to them while making that film.
It's called low budget producing, man. That's what happens. Yeah. You have to, you're a low budget producer. God bless them. They can have that job. It's not something I like to do, but you have to pull stuff out of the hat. You have to find the locations. You got to find the props and the costumes and the actors, and you got to find the money to make the bloody thing. You know, that's what you have to do. And if you don't, if you don't have that hat on straight, you know, you're going to be hurting. So
you're going to be losing pretty fast.
Yeah, you're going to be in trouble. It's just it's not an easy thing to do all the time. You know,
no. We're running out of time, my friend, but, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about your music. Before we get to that, are there any future film works that we should know about that you're working on? Are you directing something right now that's coming to the forefront?
I'm working on a science fiction series, which is a contemporary story that has sci-fi elements and also Marvel Comics type elements in it, superheroes. And it's I'm working on it with a production company here in Los Angeles called Genesis Group. And right now we're currently pitching it.
Nice.
Or they are currently pitching it for us. We are partnered with them. And it's a very cool story, a very cool piece that hasn't been done yet. And it's a series type thing, and it's an action hero series type project. you know, if I had to compare, if I had to compare it to something that's been done in the past, it's got a lot of action. It's just straight up action, not a lot of special effects and CGI. I would look at something like the original Highlander type movies where there's
not a lot of,
not a lot of green screen and effects are necessary.
Right.
It's just
a lot
more
of character building.
Yeah, it's more characters. It's more physical action, you know, and physical stuff going on, locations and practical things in camera rather than a lot of posts. Like
right.
A Marvel show now that you watch is a lot of posts. There's a ton of posts in there because they're
sure.
using certain types of powers and things are happening and whatever. And you don't in
nice.
This show, it's all about the people, the bad guys and the good guys. And they tangle with each other, you know, from time to time. So there's not going to be as much of that stuff in it, which is good. So
right.
working on that with a production company, also working on developing a feature film that is science fiction. It's all futuristic stuff. It's all, you know, CGI, a lot of CGI green screen stuff. It's that is a space adventure film, drama, and action, which I'm working on with another producer who's based up in the north. We're just about to put together, we're putting together the trailer for it now for the people he has as investors. So we
nice.
Haven't started shooting. We're just in pre-production, very long trailer pre-production. So I have
nice.
those two projects right now are in the pipeline. And one is a series, the other is a feature film.
Mm-hmm.
The series has to be picked up. It has to be bought in order for it to be seen. It could be done as a feature, but it needs to be. It really is designed to be a series.
Are you looking to direct either of them?
Yeah. I mean, I would be directing a sci-fi feature for certain because we, you know,
nice.
I basically helped to create the story for it. The other one is, I would definitely be on board as a supervising director and or, you know, directing the pilot and or the episodics here and there because you'd be bringing multiple directors for series. So, you know, we'd be bringing other people in to shoot it. But ultimately, I would be, if it's picked up, you know, we'll have a chance to work on it and shoot it. And, you know, it ain't going to be cheap to make. It's going to cost a few bucks, you know, to make it happen. So, yeah.
It costs
three or four. Yeah, there's two or three other projects that I'm pitching that are features here and there. So those two are the in the forefront, and there's a few that are in the background. And, you know, that's the way it is. It's a constant, ongoing process, what we do and doing this stuff like it is. And you know, it's a crapshoot. It's, you know, developing and writing or creating. And then you have to sell it, you know, unless you're, you know, Steve Jobs, in which
right.
case you can just go to your bank and get it out and take the money out and shoot it. I mean,
just shoot it right out there.
Wouldn't we love to have that? So, yeah, that's it. That's all she wrote, man, as far as anything that might be coming down the pipe.
I'm there. What's the future holding for you?
What's that now?
Talk to you about your music right now. How are we looking forward in the future? What's in the pipeline for you, for musically speaking?
Musically, we're, you know, I don't know if I'm going to go back into the recording studio or not. I might. It's possible I might go and do some more recording of some songs and then digitally upload them, you know, to iTunes and places like that. It's a possible consideration. I might do that. I'm not sure if and when I might do that. It's usually when I get a stockpile of songs that I haven't played before,
right.
Or that I've been playing live and just haven't recorded. So it's possible that I might put those together in another CD or put them together just record them and then upload them as additional songs to what I have on there already that's streamed.
Right.
So I haven't decided whether to do that. I haven't decided if and when I'm going to do that yet.
Right.
But other than that, it's just playing live gigs. I, you know, when this is all, you know, when we're not sequestered, that's over with, and get back to life again. I perform regularly over it.
Yeah. Now that must be a sort of hell. of because right now you can't go out and play live gigs and do like
that.
That
is correct. Yes, that is correct. I miss it already. Yeah,
wow.
I really do miss it.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, you can't play any gigs. You can't play any. You can practice at home,
right?
But you can't go out and perform live. And that also includes, you know, personal appearances and things like that. They're all done for now. So there's nothing, you know, there's not a whole lot that one can do, you know, at this point in time. You know, over, you know, 70%, 75% of production is shut down, if not most of it.
Right.
Nobody's shooting anything. You can't. So,
right.
You know, so everything is at a standstill until the veil is lifted from this thing.
Right.
To be able to get back to work, you know.
Well, thank God you're working on projects right now for the future. And, you know, when everything opens up again, it's going to be like floodgates because so many people are going to write. Yeah.
I'm certainly hoping so. certainly hoping so, yeah.
Well, you have a daughter that's an actress as well. How's it like for her right now?
Well, I mean, she just finished working on a feature film up in Northern California. She was in one of the films she was in. She played a supporting lead in a film called Candy Corn, which was released this past year.
Oh.
I think it was December 2019, and wow. that's with Tony Todd and Courtney Gaines and a few other people. So she's in that film, supporting lead. She just played the lead role in another independent feature up in Northern California. It's a low-budget sci-fi thriller, and she starred in that. So she's, you know, doing like everybody else, you know, if an opportunity comes along to read for a role or do something, she's going to go ahead and do it and see if she can book it, and that's how it goes. But she's done, you know, 3 films already. So now she's just got to break into – what she's trying to do is break a little bit into the television market. She hasn't cracked that egg just yet.
That egg
yet,
huh?
She wants to get into it. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. It's backwards now. You know, you before, if you got into television, you had to crack the egg of being in movies. But nowadays, you know, she's doing all these movies. She has to crack the egg of being on television.
Yeah. You know, it's a different venue, television, than it is independent films. Independent films are independent films, so they're not beholden to anyone else. Whereas in networks, you know, production companies on TV shows, they're beholden to the networks, and networks will give you final approval on, you know, series regular roles and things like that, and they have a bigger say so about you gotta go through more people to get those parts,
right?
And so they're typically going to want to see a more of a track record of your performances and work in television before they give you another television role.
Sure.
That's kind of how it works. Whereas, those are independent projects, and if the director likes you, then, you know, you're off to the races, you know, so.
Right.
That's the difference between the two. At this point, she'll have some really good footage from this one here. She did some things in it that she's not done before in the other projects, which can showcase her range, you know, her range and what she can do. And then she, you know, she'll have that as a really good showpiece for this. So,
We'll
see what happens.
Did you have any, you know, because I often ask a lot of actors, you know, if you have any advice, if you were younger and you found somebody younger and they asked for advice, but you actually have a daughter here. Did you have advice for her when she was going into acting of what she should and should not do?
Well, yeah, I have advice for her, you know, as long as she, you know, the trick is to get her to follow it. That's the thing. At the end of the day, like any millennial out there, they're kind of hard-headed when it comes to that kind of stuff. So, you know, they have to figure out and learn for themselves. And I kind of prefer to have someone else tell her that way, you know, she actually listens. But,
some of that? Yeah.
Well, yeah, most of the stuff that I tell her, you know, here's what you're going to have to, you should be doing A, B, and C, and you're going to have to do A, B, and C in order to get, you know, the next phase. And it's going to be tough. It's going to be difficult. There's going to be a mountain of rejection. That's what comes with the territory. And even if you don't or do like the role, doesn't matter. It's just you have to fight for literally every single thing because everybody else out there is fighting for it.
Right.
So, you know, you got to have all your ducks in a row. You got to have everything ready to go. When the door cracks open, you got to be able to step through and show it, man. And you got to be able to deliver. And,
to be ready. You have to be ready for it.
You got to be ready, yeah, because that door may not crack open again, you know, at least not for a long time.
Right.
So you have to be on top of things and get it done, you know.
Right. Now, let me ask you a question. Is there something about likability? Because you've been in so many different things, such an eclectic work, such an eclectic resume. Is there something about being likable, about people wanting to be on the set with you, that it resonates with you?
Well, you know, anybody that you're working with in any capacity on any project, you need to be, you had better make sure that you have not burned any bridges, that your relationship with them as a working relationship needs to be 100% solid and positive. Otherwise, that could be the kiss of death.
Right.
You know, because if somebody works with you and you're a pain in the butt, you know, to work with, they're going to tell everybody else. You know, I've been there. You know, I've advised people, you know, that maybe, you know, here's what you're getting into if you're going to work with this actor or this actress. Here's what you're getting into. Yeah,
right.
They may be very good at what they do. They may be very talented, but, you know, so are about 500,000 other people, you know, who are there. So do you want that headache just because of this one individual? So,
right.
You know, it is absolutely critical that you leave, you know, a production and work with people in a production and leave a very positive feeling with everyone having worked with you because, man, if you don't, they will – you know, you're not going to – that you just shot yourself in the foot. I mean, I don't know what the
right.
point of doing it for is if you're going to pollute, you know, the waters of those opportunities by, you know, acting out or not showing up on time or not having the lines together or
sure.
having an attitude and getting pissed off or, you know, complaining about this and that. Nobody wants to be bothered with that crap, man. You know, if you
right.
you show up and you do the job, you know, and you do it professionally. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to be a pain in the ass. They'll remember that and they're going to tell everybody else. That's just almost – it's just like rock bottom common sense to do it. And I've been very lucky in that most of the projects I've worked on, if not, geez, almost all of them, I have not run into anything like that at all. I have enjoyed working with almost every director. I think there was only one that had sort of a strange sort of thing about him, and it was not that pleasant to watch. But
right.
ultimately, I've enjoyed working with.
Well, there's always going to be one.
Majority of people. Yeah, there's always one, right? It was the actors, almost 110%. I think 110%. I've not worked with any actors on any professional project. Whether they were playing the lead or whether they were playing a minor role, didn't matter. They have always, always been cordial, if not outright friendly, if out and professional. And they delivered.
Right.
They did the job. I enjoyed the process, and everything was cool. I have never... you know, and partly that's because, you know, they are grateful to have a job.
Yeah,
they're grateful
exactly.
to be there. So
it was such
they're
hell
not gonna
to
mess
get
it up
there.
Either. Yeah. They're not going to mess it up either. You know,
yeah.
the guest stars, you come on as a guest star, you're sort of in somebody else's house, you know, and it's, you know, it feels, you know, you don't have the familiarity that you would have if it was your own show. And you know, you have to make them feel comfortable if you're the lead actor, the regular, and, you know, you've got a guest star. We had it on Voyager. We had guest stars every week almost. And it's like,
right,
you know,
you did.
You want them to you want to welcome them into the fold. You want to make them feel comfortable. You know, you want to be, you know, nice to them, friendly to them so that they feel comfortable, you know, because it's not their set. It's not
right.
their show. You know, they're just there for a minute to do what they got to do, and then they leave. And they're just not, their surroundings are different and people are different and they don't have the lay of the land. So, you know, you want to make them feel as much at home as possible. And if you are a guest star on the show, you want to You don't want to make any waves. You want to come in and slot into this thing like it's a well-oiled machine and do your bit and go out. And typically the director of those shows, sometimes they're the executive director, sometimes, or executive producer, sometimes they are, you know, a guest director that they've hired. And in some cases, that guest director may or may not have shot some episodes of the show already, or maybe this is the first
right.
one. So they're not, they have worked on the show, but it's not their show. So
right.
they
right.
are, they are, you know, working with the executive producers as well, trying to make sure that their work is appreciated and they can come back and do other shows down the line. You know,
right.
these are gig, you know, it's a gig career. It's a gig, you know, it's gig type work, you know. And so you
right.
never want to jeopardize your opportunity to have yet another gig at some point in time in the future.
You know, you've
that's
given us some great insight into your world. You know, it was lovely talking to you, and thank you so much for joining
thank
us
you.
Today. Tim Russ, you know, is there any way we can reach you or look at some of your stuff or maybe find some of your music? How can we do that?
Yeah. Well, it's on a lot of that's on my website,
okay.
which is timrusswebpage.com. You know, if anybody just Googles my name, it's going to be the first three or four things. The webpage is going to come up. You'll see it.
Nice.
It's timrusswebpage.com. That's my website. It's got my, you know, some of the projects I'm working on, the appearances I will have coming up when they are coming up now. And
right.
it's got links to my music. It's got links to my acting. It's got my demo on there, my acting demo, comedy and drama. You can see some of the stuff I've done. I've got stuff on my own YouTube channel under Tim Russ. You can look at some of the things on there. And a lot of our music is on iTunes right now. So you can listen to all the samples of everything I've done. I think it's all on there. And
right.
so you got between those, the website, YouTube, and the iTunes, Amazon's got some of my music as well. So you can go a number of places to hear it. It's out there. You know, it's a couple of taps on the keyboard to get to it.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
It's not very difficult to find you. There's not a lot of Tim Russes out there. I'll be honest with you.
No, nope, there are not. I don't have a terribly common name, and you know, once you see you're on the page, you can actually see my picture, and you know it's me. So if they're familiar
right.
with me and the work, they're going to know they're on the right spot. And everything is basically available for people to look at or watch. I just completed a new music video for the song that I wrote a while back called "We," which is
nice.
I think is definitely on the YouTube channel now, a bunch of other stuff is on there. I've got a short film called "Plugged," I think it is on there, which is fun to watch, the band performances are all on there. I think, yeah, I'm pretty sure they are. And
right.
so there's a lot of stuff on there that you can take a look at and watch and stuff. A feature film I just finished directing that was released last year as well. I think it was released in early December also, called Junkie, which
really?
Is Christian Kane and Robert Duvall. This is not the Robert Duvall. This is different.
Okay.
Jimmy Duvall. My fault.
Oh, Jimmy Duvall.
Jimmy
okay.
Duvall. Jimmy Duvall. Christian Kane.
Okay.
They are, that film was released in December of this last year. And, that is going to be on Amazon as well. I think right now, I think it's on Amazon.
Right.
And that's a drama, small town, young woman who's a drug addict who has to kick the habit in order to try to find out what happened to her brother, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a drama.
Right.
And it's that I directed a couple of years ago. They just released it. So I, you know, all that stuff is out there, and I'm pretty sure that most of it's listed on my website.
Right.
Last I checked. So, yeah.
Right.
There you go.
Well, Tim, it's been our honor to have you on the show. We've been wanting to have you on for quite a while here. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you have a blessed weekend, and I hope your family's doing well right now. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Will do, man. Thank you. Take care.
That was Tim Russ. Thank you, Tim Russ.
Thank you.
Goodbye, my friend.
Yeah. All right, bye-bye.
Well, that was Tim Russ. What an amazing human being. What did I tell you at the beginning of the show? What an amazing human being. I mean, he has a litany of work. I mean, if you look at his resume, it's impossible to not be shocked at all the things he's accomplished in his life. From Hill Street Blues to, I mean, Twilight Zone to, I mean, Star Trek Voyager to iCarly. He's one of the very few people in Star Trek that has gone throughout almost every single realm of TV shows. In Deep Space Nine, Star Trek Voyager, Next Generation. He was in Star Trek Generations, the movie. Really incredible personality. Very wise. Father was in the Air Force. Traveled the world when he was very young. Majored in theater. Moved out to LA and just took all the parts he could, which were all every single show I saw as a child. Worked with Leonard Nimoy before he ever worked on Star Trek. I mean, if you want to talk about life imitating art, that's incredible. That should tell you that nothing is impossible. The way he talked, the way he shared information, tells you that nothing is impossible. Just work, work, work. Writer, cinematographer, director, actor, musician. There's nothing this man does not do. Thank you, Tim Russ, for joining us today. We are the ones who are blessed to have you on. You're an incredible personality, an incredible person. And a lot of people have learned a lot of things from you being on. Strength. Perseverance. Understanding how to be a good personality while on set. Being welcoming, being kind. You know, one of the reasons why Tim Russ was invited back to all these shows was because he was a likable personality and people liked him. People wanted to talk to him. They wanted to hear from him. So that's the incredible thing about Tim Russ. I've been waiting a long time to have him on the show, and I'm very thankful. Now to all you out there living in La La Land, under lockdown, find your happiness, pursue your happiness. He's still writing, Tim Russ is still writing, still wanting to direct, still wanting to do his music. He's waiting in anticipation to get out there and play for his live crowds. Now that's a personality. I didn't feel like there was a shortage of confidence that it was going to happen. That he was going to be okay, that everybody's going to be okay, and that it was going to happen. I think that's a great attitude to have. Not living in fear, but waiting for the clouds to part and for the sun to come out. It's easy to look at the news and be afraid. It's easy. It's difficult to know deep in your heart that things will be okay and we will survive these things. And to my audience, thank you so much for joining us today. God bless you all. I love you so much. You give me a chance to speak my mind and to have great people on my show. I am the one who's truly blessed here. I have a wonderful time every single time. This has been Cinema Files Radio. I'm your host, Steve Pisa. Thank you so much for joining us today. Be well. I love you all.